3. Itale rode down from Grasse in late evening of the last day of June. Tired, on a tired horse, he rode through the drab fields of burdock, shards, shacks, tramps, sour earth, and into the long streets of the Trasfiuve, and crossed Old Bridge under the statue of St. Christopher of the Wayfarers, remembering the morning of the autumn equinox 3 years ago. He put up at a small inn just off Molsen Boulevard, ordered dinner, and went to bed very soon after he had eaten. He would look up his friends, take up his life, tomorrow. Tonight he wanted only to sleep. The room was small, and with the curtains drawn very dark. He got up again at once and drew back the curtains, opened both the windows wide to the warm, noisy city night. He had almost fallen asleep when the bell of the cathedral, a few streets away, struck 10. After that he lay wide awake in the darkness, suffering all the memories and presences of his time in Krasnoy, from the moment when he had first heard that bell strike, the 2 years in which so much life had been compressed that they seemed to lie like a fiery bar of sunlight between the remote, long, quiet years in the shadow of the mountains, and the unimaginable but immediate past, the 27 months of darkness. As he breakfasted in the hot morning at a street café in the river quarter, he debated going back to the inn, lying low for another day. He had not got much rest. He mistrusted himself, his energy, his strength. What would he have to face here? Riding from the Sovenna, he had been very nervous at first, avoiding every town entry and possible checkpoint that he could avoid, dreading the request to show his papers. That dread had lessened as he was, at one point and then another, checked cursorily and passed. But what was the situation here? He did not really know, and was apprehensive. However, he had to take Louisa's horse to the Paludescar stables in Rocas Street, and he was going to have to get some money. He could not afford another night at the inn. Emmanuel had loaned him 50 kroner, of which he had 16 left in his pocket, less than he had arrived with the first time 5 years ago. Less all round, he thought, coming back down from Old Quarter to the river and walking up the boulevard under the trees by the bright water. Less cash, less strength, less time to live, less of a man to stand up against the storming of the human world and the universe at his mind and body, the storm of light and wind and sensation and passion that never ceased, never rested until death. For the walls of a building, a prison, were dust in that storm. He felt peculiarly slight, light, insubstantial, as he walked up the wide street by the river, a flickering thing, exposed, uncertain. This mote, this speck between the sun in its gulfs of light and the earth with its long shadow, this was himself, Itale Sorde, and he was supposed to withstand the entire universe in order to remain himself. Not only that, to do his job, to be a part of it. It was a strange business to be a man walking in the sunlight, stranger than to be a stone or a river or a tree holding up its branches in the July heat. They all knew what they were doing. He did not. He passed two little girls hurrying with their hard-breathing nurse towards the far mirage of a sherbet vendor's cart. He saw their pigtails bob on their thin shoulders. How long since he had seen a child? He had reached the office of Novesma Verba. He turned to the parapet and leaned his hands on it, watching the bright Molsen go towards the sea. So far to go from this inland country, my shoreless kingdom, Amade had called it in the ode. So far to go for a bitter end, and nameless. Come on, he said to himself, come on, Itale. And straightened up, turned, crossed the street, went up the stairs to the journal's office. In his determination, and out of old habit, he did not knock, but went straight in. A young fellow stepped out in front of him from behind the table. "What do you want?" "Who's here?" Itale said, stammering, unnerved. He did not know whether he had forgotten this man, or never known him. "Mr. Brelavi is busy with a visitor. I'm Vernoy." He was young, 20 at most, and shone with self-confidence. Itale, vulnerable to every impression, was impressed by that youthfulness, and, casting about for something to say, asked, "Are you from Amictia?" Then he remembered that the student society had been put under ban, and several of its leaders at the university in Krasnoy arrested, a few months before his release. It was a very stupid question, and the boy rapped out, "Who are you?"
"Sorde. Itale Sorde. Sorry. I wanted..."
"You're Sorde?" Itale said yes, he was. Vernoy fell to pieces like wet paper, waved his hands, ran for Brelavi. Brelavi came, carrying his dark face like a long, ironical signboard on top of his long body, exactly the same, unchanged, so that Itale laughed with pure joy at the sight of him. But his friend, embracing him, sobbed and would not let him go.
"Here, come on, Tomas."
They could not look at each other.
"Come on. Wait, here it is."
Brelavi found his handkerchief and blew his nose.
"Almighty Christ, Itale,"
he said tenderly.
"What did you have?"
"Have?
What were you ill with?"
"Typhus."
"No joke, eh?"
"Not a very good one."
"Here, come along. Why are we standing around my handkerchief like a scene from Othello?"
Note. Compare Othello, Act 3, Scene 4. End note.
"San Justo's in here. Remember him, Itale? Almighty Christ, to say your name again. Where are you staying? I didn't try to write you in the Sovena. Your baroness said better not to when she wrote. Has to watch her reputation, political, of course. She kept you hidden there long enough. I expect you needed it."
He had his arm around Itale's shoulders and was steering him into the composing room, where, considerably shaken by his own feelings and Brelavi's, Itale found himself returning a handshake and looking into a face that completed his confusion by bringing around him the moonlight, the sound of fountains, Luisa's voice, Piera's voice, the carriages on Fontamana Street. When all that subsided, he was sitting down feeling a little sick, and the others were around him looking concerned.
"Sorry, I'm still shaky. How are you, San Justo?"
"Very well, Sorde."
"You're staying in Krasnoy?"
"Yes, since 2 weeks. I'm tired of England. I come here,"
said the Italian. He spoke mostly in the present tense. His voice was calm, his manner relaxed, and in his smile there was a hint of complicity. Itale felt at ease with him at once.
"But it's not the same mood here as in 27, even in Eisenach. It's agitated, bad-tempered. But who knows? I come from England. Everyone on the continent is agitated and emotional, nay?"
"What about Paris?"
Brelavi asked.
"Oh, well, Paris. The Ultra, Royer Collar, Article 14, lovers, chestnut trees, old men catching little fishes in the Seine. Paris is always the same, and who can predict of her?"
Note. The Ultra, ultra-royalists, were conservative supporters of the restored Bourbon dynasty. Pierre-Paul Royer-Collard, 1763-1845, was a leader of the Doctrinaire, a group of political thinkers who had reconciled the liberal principles of the Revolution of 1789 with the legitimacy of the monarchy. Article 14 of the Charter of 1814 gave the king the power to promulgate legislation by decree during an emergency. The invocation of Article 14 by Charles X on July 25, 1830, led to an insurrection in Paris and his forced abdication. End note. They laughed, and again San Justo shot a quick accomplice's glance at Itale. With some sense of playing a role, Itale asked the questions Brelavi had a right to expect him to ask, about recent events, political trends, and changes.
"If there's any change," Brelavi said, "it's a change of mood, as San Justo said. Underneath, in people, in the people. On top, nothing. The ministry's the same except for Roscainescar replacing Tarven. The assembly mumbles on, the Grand Duchess is ill. Maybe. Not ill. Maybe. All rumor. But 3 years ago there were no rumors, said San Justo.
Taxes were heavier, Brelavi went on, political arrests increasingly common, administrative sentences without trial or term had been introduced, the Student Society and several other groups had been put under ban, censorship was massive, and all mail likely to be read. There had been 2 bad harvests and unemployment in the cities of the East, and center was high.
Some cause for bad temper, Itale said. They blame it all on the assembly, even the bad harvests.
Your assembly is the expiatory. What do you call it, the scapegoat for Austria? The prime minister sees to that.
How's Aragon been doing? Itale asked.
Damn Aragon, Brelavi said. He's not our Danton, Itale. He's our Talleyrand.
Note. Charles Maurice de Talleyrand Périgord, 1754-1838, French politician and diplomat whose career spanned successive regimes from Louis XVI to Napoleon to Louis Philippe. He served as Foreign Minister of France, 1797-1807, and represented France at the Congress of Vienna, 1814-15. End note.
A demagogic one. The shit's in a wooden shoe instead of a silk stocking.
Note. Talleyrand was mistrusted by Napoleon, who berated him in front of his marshals as shit in a silk stocking. End note.
The nation be hanged if Stefan Aragon can climb a little higher on the gallows.
Louisa said that my pardon was largely due to him.
It was. He needs our good press, and you were the price he had to pay for it.
Well, how is Frenin?
Fine. He's in Solari.
For the paper?
Living there.
In Solari? What's going on there?
What always did. Students, cattle fairs, everybody asleep by 9. He's a grain shipper, doing well, I hear. He left Krasnoy a few weeks after we heard you'd been arrested.
Itale still looked blank.
He got cold feet, Brelavi said gently.
Brelavi, Frenin, Itale had been friends long before they thought of coming to the capital, and it had been Frenin who brought them, Frenin who said, how long ago, in the park by the Blue Molsen in the sunlight, I'm thinking of Krasnoy. It was an old bitterness to Brelavi, to Itale a blow. He could not escape the conviction that to have suffered, to have submitted to evil, though he had had no way at all to refuse it, had made him a cause of evil. It was because of him that Frenin had given up. In the conscious and painful acceptance of this responsibility, he sat silent for a minute. He weighed a broken inkstand that was on the table in his hand, and said finally,
Thomas, do you know anything about Isaber?
Absolutely no trace. Nothing. They denied consistently from the beginning that he was in Saint-Lazare, claimed he'd been released with an order to get out of the province. Beyond that, nothing.
He had lived with the boy's death for 2 years in prison. He had not known till the hope was taken from him how much hope he had kept, hidden, that when he came out he would find it had been a mistake, a cruel hoax, a nightmare of his own, and Isaber was alive. This also, this inescapably, was his responsibility. He was answerable for this death. Brelavi asked him nothing, seeing that he was distressed and assuming that he knew even less than they about what had become of the boy. San Justo stood up, stretching, and said in English,
To fresh fields and pastures new.
Note. From the end of John Milton's pastoral elegy, Lycidas. End note.
I have eaten nothing. Come on, I told Jivan I'd meet him at the Illyrica at 1,
Brelavi said, relieved to get away from the unlucky subject. Jivan Karantai had not changed. He was dark and warm as a banked fire. They sat 2 hours over their coffee cups, talking. 2 or 3 young men came up and asked if they might be introduced to Mr. Sorda. Itale shook their hands and was short with them. They went humbly away.
"You're their hero, their Voltura, dear fellow," said Karantai.
"God forbid." "God forbid indeed," Brelavai said. "Voltura's dead, died in the Spielberg in 28.
"Where Silvio Pellico, who knew Byron, is now," said San Giusto in his calm voice.
Note: Silvio Pellico, 1789 to 1854, Italian poet and patriot. His literary review, the Conciliatore, was suppressed by the Austrian authorities, and he was arrested in Milan in 1820. Convicted of treason in 1822, he was held in the Spielberg prison until his release in 1830. End note.
There must be good company in the Spielberg prison.
Now Itale knew why San Giusto looked at him as if there were a tacit bond between them. There was. San Giusto had spent 3 years in the Piombi in Venice as a political prisoner. Note: the Piombi in Venice, formerly a prison inside the Doge's palace in Venice, its most famous prisoner was the writer and libertine Giacomo Casanova, 1725 to 1798. End note. Brelavai, Karantai, the young men, wanted to hear and dared not ask about his jail term. San Giusto did not want to hear, did not need to ask. Foreigner, exile, he was Itale's compatriot. Arguments concerning Stefano Ragone surfaced occasionally, and in the course of one of them San Giusto put in, "But he is a professional, isn't he? And you are amateurs, myself too.
The coup d'etats are made by professionals.
They succeed. The revolutions are made by amateurs."
"And fail?" Brelavai inquired.
"Of course."
"But listen, San Giusto," Karantai said. "The words are good. It was amateurs that made 89 all right. The crowds, the people that walked to Versailles and took the Bastille, and the Assembly, the Girondins, the Jacobins, they were lawyers, provincial men of letters, not politicians. But as they learned their trade, as they became professional, the revolution began to fail to lead inevitably towards the coup d'etat that betrayed it."
"They did never learn their trade," the Italian said. "Robespierre is always an amateur. The professional is Napoleon. The question is really this: what is failure, what is success? The revolution failed, yes, and Napoleon is a very successful man, a conqueror, an emperor. But it was the failure, not the success, that gives hope to our life."
"Vivre libre ou mourir,"
Itale said, and laughed.
"Exactly, Vergniaud. A professional lawyer, very successful in his profession. A nice lazy fellow, an amateur deputy, unsuccessful."
San Giusto cut his throat with the side of his hand.
"A fine career cut short. But first he told us to live free or die. Why did you laugh, Sorda?"
"Found I'd rather stay alive, even if not free."
"Of course, for 2 years, 3 years, or longer. But here we are now, alive and free."
"Alive," Itale said.
His money problem had been promptly solved, as Brelavai told him peremptorily that he had 28 months' wages waiting at Novesma Verba.
"It's been very useful, the most cash we ever kept on hand. I don't know how many loans we've made from it to get people over a thin time, but they always repaid, because it was your money. If it was my money or our money, they'd have embezzled freely."
Karantai had asked him to come share his rooms. He hesitated.
"A friend was keeping my old rooms for me when I went to Rakova. I should go see whether he's there."
Karantai went with him into the river quarter, past St. Stephen's and the Street of Hangman's Feast, the swarming courts and alleys under toppling houses in the shadow of the hill of the university.
"No change here," Itale remarked.
"Not for 500 years, said Karantai.
At 9 Malenastrada, Mrs. Rosa, cat-beleaguered, greeted her long-lost tenant without warmth.
"Your things are here, Mr. Sorda. I'll be glad to have him out of my way."
"Is Mr. Brunoy here?" She looked him up and down.
"No."
She knew him to be a jailbird, but his voice and clothing said gentleman. She wanted him to be a gentleman. She had had enough of jailbirds in her life, but she could not trust him. He had let her down, and her voice was vindictive as she said,
"He died here 2 years ago. Koune's got the rooms."
"I see," Itale said. After a moment, he asked submissively if Koune was in. Mrs. Rosa stood aside, and he and Karantai climbed the dark rickety stairs. Koune came from behind his loom.
"We was very sorry to hear, Mr. Sorda," he said. "It's good to see you."
Itale shook his hand and stopped to play with the baby, not born when he left and now a solemn 2-year-old. The delicate face, the dark eyes, gazed into Itale's.
"What's her name, Koune?"
"It's a him. He's on the small side, makes him look like a girl. We call him Liva. There's a couple of things I kept for you here."
Koune rummaged in the other room and returned with a small packet of papers which he gave to Itale, several letters written from Malafrena in the autumn of 1827, and a scrap of paper, one downhill scrawl of barely readable writing on it, "Prometheus, no chains eternal."
"Mr. Brunoy wrote that for you a day or two before he died," Koune said.
Itale gave it to Karantai and walked away to the window.
"Did you know him, Jivan?" he asked.
"Not well. He used to come to the office for word of you."
Itale stood with his back turned.
"He was an upright man."
"That he was," said the weaver, "and a good death. He couldn't talk when he wrote you that, but at the end he spoke. He raised up and said, 'I'm ready,' like a bridegroom going to his wedding. I looked to see who he was talking to, and he lay back, quiet and content, and his breath caught, like, and he died. I wished the priest had stayed. I never saw a better death."
"Aye," Itale said. "It was what he knew how to do."
He took the slip of paper back from Karantai and slipped it folded into the back of his watch.
"How does it go, Koune?"
"I've kept working."
He looked up at Itale.
"We're in your rooms now. There being 6 of us, we spread out a bit, but if you want—"
"No, I won't be coming back, Koune. Did she raise the rent on you?"
"No, and she didn't ask rent of Mr. Brunoy at the end, so that the little he had put by for it and the books and his watch paid to bury him. She's all right. Knows when times are hard."
Kneeling, Itale put out his hand to the frail, solemn little boy in his sexless, shapeless, worn dress.
"Goodbye, Liva," he said. The contrast in size of their hands was too much.
He touched the child's cheek. He stood up, shook hands with Koune, bidding him goodbye. They went on to Karantai's rooms south of the Elena Prada. Karantai had kept a letter for Itale from Amade Estenskar, dated February 6, 1828. Itale began to read it, laid it down, and put his head in his hands.
"I can't read any more letters from the dead," he said.
Karantai had the top floor of a house, a big set of rooms, sparsely furnished, with high, large windows. Itale paced down the uncarpeted floor and back, and sat down again wearily.
"They all died today," he said.
"They haven't been very good years, these last 2 or 3, Karantai said gently.
"What's wrong? What is it that's wrong, Jivan?"
"I don't know. Speaking for myself, nothing. I go on writing. It's all I care about, you know, really. I make a living by it. I'm going to get married in September."
"Married? To Karela?"
Karantai nodded. He had been in love a long time and had never been willing to talk about it. Itale could not tell even now whether his reticence expressed coolness of feeling or suppressed a happiness he felt egoistical and unseemly. "So, as I say, I have all I have ever asked for myself. But for us all together, they haven't been good years. You in jail, Amade dead, Frenin giving up.
Who can blame them? We knew all along we were pounding our heads on a stone wall trying to knock it down, but one's head gets sore and addled. Then there have been so many searches and summonses. Tomas has been called up 3 times now. And these damnable administrative sentences, they frighten us all. And the censorship so heavy? I wonder why anybody still bothers to read Verba. Sometimes. But they do read it. Our subscription list has doubled in the last year and a half. And there are young men coming up, and men like San Justo. There are more of us than there used to be. It's only that the waiting's long, and we've never known for certain what it is we're waiting for. No change there. But we're a couple of years older. Itale smiled. The kind of sobriety of Karantai's temper refreshed him now, as always. Waiting, he said. That's not true of you, Givon. You have your work. But I have never worked. I've only made ready. The time will come, Itale. Will it? Is there any time but now? Karantai did not answer. I don't know, Givon. I have lost. I have no right to speak of this.
You have earned the right to speak of anything.
No, that's exactly it. I have earned nothing, nothing. You don't earn, you don't gain where I was, Givon. You lose. You lose the right to talk to people who believe in the powers of light. What I learned there was that I have no rights, and infinite responsibility.
That would be infinite injustice. It's false, Itale.
I would rather trust you than myself, Itale said. I wish I could. I was a better man before.
He cut himself off, standing up abruptly.
I'm very tired. Maybe I should lie down for a while.
He went off to the spare room. At 8, Karantai looked in to go out to supper with him. He was sound asleep, and Karantai hesitated to waken him. He looked down at Itale's face, worn and sleep-submerged, and then out the uncurtained open window westward over roofs and gables and chimney-stacks, the high view smoky and shadowed in long evening light. It was hot. There was no wind. Karantai stood there beside the friend he had not hoped to see again, wishing that there would be a wind off the river, darkness, rain. But the weather was steady. It would not change. On the bureau, a silver watch lay open. It said 2:30. Karantai tapped it, but it did not run. He spoke to Itale at last, rousing him, and they went down to the inn where Karantai took his meals. July passed, a long, hot July, and August came in hot. Itale was still with Karantai. The novelist had pressed him to stay, and he had yielded easily, lacking any real wish to go out and find himself a room. The impermanence of the arrangement, Karantai's affectionate, reserved companionship, suited him. Companionship, friendship, he wanted very much, but he could not take hold here. He could not recommit himself to anything but his friends. He waited, irresolute, drifting, and increasingly tense, though his health continued to improve, taking comfort in being with Karantai, Brelavai, San Justo, and the others, waiting for alternate Mondays when the mail from the Montaigna diligence came in, waiting to decide where he was going to stay in Krasnoy, and whether he was going to stay in Krasnoy. Waiting. He did not know for what. George Heleskar was traveling in Germany, not due back for a few weeks. Itale had gone to pay his respects to the old count and had been received with emotion that was painful to him. The tough old man was over 80 now, and his invitation was pleading.
You could stay here, you know. I've lost count of the rooms standing empty.
He asked about Luisa, and even mentioned Estenskar, whom he had never liked.
A bit of the real fireworks, that lad. One fine burst and it was over. He had the sense to know it and not go sputtering on for 50 years, boring the cosmos.
I wonder if most of us don't bore the cosmos,
Itale said to Karantai as they strolled back through the Elena Prade in the fag end of the warm evening.
"It's my profession," said the novelist. "Anyhow, I'd rather bore it than be bored by it."
A man in what had been a respectable coat came up to them begging. Itale talked with him a while.
"That's a new trade for him,"
he said when the man had gone off with their small joint contribution.
"How many out of work now? One of every three or four, I should think."
"Vernoy says the river docks are working less than half the men this summer.
So's the assembly,"
Itale said with a glance at the Sinalia Palace looming pale and somber behind the splendid chestnut alleys.
"I wonder why the Grand Duchess has shut herself up in the Rauch."
"Afraid of demonstrations, Aragon says."
"The Sinalia is more vulnerable. I wonder what it is she really fears."
"Damned Austrian cow in the throne room of Eugene the Great. She needs to be taught her place."
Karantai laughed.
"You're fierce lately."
"So's everyone else. It's hot, we're tired. My God, we're tired. Will it ever change? I came here 5 years ago. All that time, all my life, all our lives, Givon, since we were born, the net's been drawing tighter. The air's been getting staler. There's been less and less room to move. Europe is like a pond in drought, drying up."
"And the Austrian cattle drinking the last of the water," said Karantai.
They walked on. An owl flew across the path in front of them from one oak to another, hunting, soft as a tossed ball of dark wool in the dusk. Brelavi, who had taken over Itale's editorship of Novesma Verba, wanted to give it back to him, but Itale had temporized, and most of the others agreed with him that they had to be cautious. He was, after all, a convicted seditionist, and any public act put both himself and his collaborators at risk. He had drawn enough to live on out of the fund that Brelavi insisted was his back wages, but was not currently on the staff. He served, however, as an unpaid employee along with San Giusto, who was working as a very slightly paid reporter at the Assembly. Their reportership was more than anything else a test, to find if they could, with impunity, reconnect themselves with the journal. So the two of them sat in the gallery of the Assembly Room in the hot afternoons, listening to the order of the day dragging on, in Latin, below them among the scanty ranks of the Eastern General. No other reporters ever bothered to attend. The Courier Mercury got its list of motions direct from the President. San Giusto and Itale allayed their boredom one afternoon by inventing the debates in the Egyptian National Dynastic Assembly of both kingdoms on August 11, 1830 B.C. The President: "I recognize Mr. Ephesus, the deputy from Karnak." Note. Similarly, Samuel Johnson, 1709 to 1784, reported on the British parliamentary debates from 1741 to 1744 for the Gentleman's Magazine. Forbidden to report the debates directly, Johnson adopted the guise of Debates in the Senate of Lilliput, using Jonathan Swift's imaginary miniature kingdom to stand for England. End note. Mr. Ephesus: "My lords, gentlemen, are we to credit the unsupported allegation of the Honorable Deputy from Two Upon Nile that two wagon loads of perishable produce such as pullet eggs and radishes and a small cart containing mummified cats were detained for 62 hours for examination at the west gate of His Divine Highness' capital city? Is it positively known, can it be subject to material proof, that the pullet eggs and radishes were rendered unfit for consumption, and that the mummified cats deteriorated in quality due to the alleged detention for examination?" Brelavi slipped their farce into Novesma Verba, signing it Cheops, and the censor passed it. Note. Cheops, 4th Dynasty Egyptian Pharaoh, 2589 to 2566 BCE, also called Khufu, who commissioned the Great Pyramid at Giza. End note. It was the journal's last report of debates in the Assembly. At the opening next day, Prime Minister Cornelius appeared on the rostrum to request adjournment of the assembly until October, on the part of the Grand Duchess Maria, whose indisposition, aggravated by the inclement weather, forbade her the study and exercise of judgment required for the sanction or veto of decrees voted by the assembly convened by her gracious favor. The president, a right-wing noble, closed debate and adjourned the session, and as protest began from the left, a concerted exit by the right took enough deputies out that the protesters lacked the quorum of 70. It all took 6 or 8 minutes. Itala and San Giusto had to compare notes to be sure they knew what had occurred. They went off at once to the Café Illyrica with the news, but it had preceded them. Men out of work wanted nothing better than a subject of talk, a subject of indignation. The closure of the parliament, to which nobody had paid any attention, drew the attention of the whole city. Itala and San Giusto, themselves out of work again, wandered the hot, restless streets, watching and listening. The park was full of people, as if it were some festival day. The city watch had been posted at the gates of the Sinalia Palace, empty now at the end of its long chestnut-shaded mall. The palace guard were on duty at the Rauch, which stood tawny and dour over its square, baking in the August sun. Shops along Palazzi Street between the two palaces were mostly closed and shuttered as if for holiday. Molsen Boulevard lay long and empty above the empty river. One barge came down, black in the blinding sun glare, as Itala and San Giusto strolled to the journal's office. Oragon was there, fresh from court. All doors there, he said, were locked, all mouths shut. Only one rumor was afloat, that a courier had arrived last night from Vienna. But couriers were always arriving.
"The Emperor's dead," said young Verneuil. "Almighty Christ," said Berlavi, "it's Metternich that's dead."
"Impossible," said San Giusto. "Metternich lives forever. Is the Grand Duchess perhaps really sick?"
Oragon, sitting sideways on the long composing table, his coat off and his stock loosened, shook his big rough head.
"No sicker than yesterday. She was at Mass this morning in Rauch Chapel. Cancer she may have, but that won't explain today's move."
His voice, with its slurring eastern accent, dominated all others, and though he looked hot and baffled, he was enjoying his power to dominate, to give answers, to force the respect of these self-willed journalists who had lost confidence in him. He turned now, as he always, instinctively, turned to the man in whom he sensed authority or symbolic value for the group, and spoke to him as deep unto deep.
"What's the mood in the streets now, Sorde?"
"Do I know?"
Oragon's knowingness jarred on Itala.
"The same as the mood in here, I suppose. We're all in the same boat."
"It's the unemployed mobs they're afraid of," said young Verneuil with his sententious and irresistible self-assurance. "They've closed the assembly because it's a potential rallying center."
"Rallying about what?" said Brelavi. "Why the hugger-muggering in the Rauch? Why have all the ostriches put their heads in the sand?"
"Well, Verneuil must be right," Carantai said. "But why so abruptly? They've created the disturbance they were trying to avoid. It's not like Cornelius. His reasons must be pressing."
The discussion went round and round, moved on to the Illyrica, went on, got nowhere. Words and men came and went. It was 9 o'clock. Itala's head ached. He sat gazing at his glass of beer, the drift of foam at the rim. He picked it up and drank it off, and as he set it down, saw Oragon making his way among the tables to him. The deputy bent down and said in a low voice,
"Come out of here a moment, Sorde."
"What's up?"
"I want a word with you."
He took Itala's arm and led him off across Tiponti Street, but he could not wait till they had got across the street into the park to speak. In the midst of passing traffic, in the dusty darkness broken by cab lanterns, he said aloud, his face close to Itala's,
"There's been a revolution in France. King Charles is dethroned. He went too far, violated the charter.
The city won't take it. They fought in the streets. The Duke of Bordeaux will be made constitutional king.
Note. After the July Revolution of 1830, which overthrew Charles X, Charles's grandson Henri of Artois, Count of Chambord and Duke de Bordeaux, 1820 to 1883, was declared by conservative legitimists to be Henri V, King of France. As heir to the Bourbon monarchs, he continued to be the pretender to the throne until his death. End note.
They stood still amongst the horses, the rolling wheels.
Is that it, then?
That's it. Charles tried to dissolve the Chamber of Deputies, overshot his authority. He abdicated on the 30th of July. The fighting must have been over for 12 days now. The new king will be sworn to fealty to the Constitution. It's the end of absolute monarchy in France.
The end, Itale repeated.
The flashing darkness and noise of the traffic, the smell of dust and horse sweat and hot stone, it was familiar. He knew these words, this moment.
And the beginning, where did you find out?
Friend in Vienna, through a friend in Eisenach. You and I are among the dozen or so people in the whole country that know it.
Itale was struck by Oragon's evident satisfaction as he said this, mixed with a kind of urgent confusion. Still gripping Itale's arm, the deputy went on.
What do we do with it? What do we do with it? It's a bombshell. Cornelius knows that. What do we do with it, Sorde?
Throw it. Let everybody know. That's what they're afraid of, isn't it? You announce it at the Illyrica. I'll get some fellows to print up something for the provinces.
Itale laughed as he spoke. He felt that the moment was much too large for him, that the noise of hooves and wheels on cobblestones was the only convincing part of it. He and the rest of them were suddenly playing a role in history, and for this reason he felt artificial, like any private man up on a stage. At the same time, it was, at last, easy to make decisions. The time had come. All one had to do at such a moment, when the walls fell down, was go ahead in the direction one had always tried to go. Oragon was flustered and two-minded only because he had never had any one direction to his actions, any fidelity. Enormously ambitious, energetic, emotional, he lacked the necessary passion. But he was very quick. He caught Itale's meaning at once and wanted no more from him, having received his impetus.
All right, good. Here's the note from Vienna with the details. Go to the press as fast as you can before they close it on us. I'll let the city know.
As Itale, Carantai, and San Giusto left the Illyrica together, they heard Oragon, up on one of the sidewalk tables, telling the news in his big, slurring voice.
The French Revolution is accomplished! They've got the freedom they fought for 40 years ago. The last Bastille is fallen. And their chance is ours. The same choice, the same chance. Is this France's victory and glory, or Europe's, ours? Will we sit quiet and let Metternich send more troops here to keep us quiet and suck us dry? I say recall the National Assembly and Sovenskar to the throne of the free kingdom.
The traffic seemed to have halted, cab lamps and café lanterns shining on many faces upturned to the orator. All things moveless, as things seen in a flash of lightning. The three men slipped away, hurried down dark streets towards the river.